NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety. The Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. Always good to see you. And of course, we are scattered around the countryside. Well, I think we got an interesting show today. We're going to talk about the Learjet, that landing gear problem that ended up in the fatality of the captain landing in Scottsdale. Todd, since you've been doing all the research, since you're our archivist and researcher and everything else, why don't you get us started with the Learjet?
Well, this is a fairly recent event. We're doing this show on March 3rd, 2025, and this is an accident that happened less than a month ago on February 10th in Scottsdale. This was a Learjet that was a Lear 35A that was coming into Scottsdale, Arizona, after making a refueling stop in Austin, Texas. And during landing, the aircraft, the left landing gear had failed before landing, and it had departed the runway off toward the left side and ran into an aircraft that was on the side. Unfortunately, the pilot was killed. The co-pilot survived, as did the two passengers in the back. But the interesting thing about this is this condition of the main landing gear prior to landing. There are plenty of videos and photos prior to the crash, as well as during and after the crash. And the preliminary report, which is going to be available on our website, it has pictures of the landing gear, and it was in a very, very unusual configuration.
It is obvious that the NTSB is using those videos and, of course, the photographs. It's apparent that the landing gear did suffer a failure when it was coming down, and that apparently the crew didn't know that the landing gear had failed into this precarious position, which literally, John, it twisted the landing gear almost 180 degrees when it came out of the wheel well, because you can see in the picture that Todd was talking about that's in the NTSB prelim, that the landing light is actually shining on the landing, on the flap itself, which suggests that the landing gear had not only really got cockeyed, but actually twisted 180 degrees. But it's evident that the crew didn't know about it because they continued the landing. They didn't request any kind of special help or a flyby of the tower to check the gear. So, you know, the micro switch that said, hey, you got three green, well, they had three green. It's just that the landing gear itself, probably at the strut and, you know, the lower part of that strut structure, had failed. When you looked at it, John, what could you tell just from those pictures?
Two things were obvious. First off, when you lower the landing gear, there is a drag strut that locks down and locks. So it's on an angle. And it was gone. And you could see the landing gear twisted, which meant that one of the attach points up on the spar, up on the wing, had to be disconnected. So structurally, the landing gear was not attached to the airplane. It takes all three points, two points being the pivots, parallel with the wingtip to body fuselage. All right, so that holds it. That gives it a swivel, and the drag strut locks it in place, either up or down. It's out of the way and up, but it's over center on down. So it was obvious that those were broken. Very unusual. It's not something you would see very often. Now, the number one cause for something like that could be a very hard landing. And there's a hard landing in the records for this airplane. And then there's an inspection that was done, and there was a lot of maintenance work that was done. What this report doesn't tell us, it doesn't go into great detail past the work that was done, you know, and I'm holding my breath because all the years that I was at the board, when we came up to these maintenance adventures or misadventures by the maintenance department, the board, all the staff always stopped short of going into the detail that they go into with the flight crew when there's a screw up. And the consequences of that is there is research money at the FAA into why people make mistakes.
Yeah.
And they spend a lot of money on pilots because the reports focused on their mistakes. But when we have a maintenance error, we come up to the hangar doors and we say, oh, maintenance did it, and go away. Consequently, the dollars that could be spent helping get better procedures, better training, all the things that we need to have a much more robust maintenance operation are always missed. And it drove me crazy while I was there, pushing on those. And I didn't win all the time, needless to say. I did win a few. And I'm concerned with this one because they really have done a good job coming up to this point. But they need to finish it, you know, and I'll give you a good example, a simple one. Somebody greased this gear when they reinstalled it after the inspection. The grease all went around the fitting and filled up an area that's very difficult to see, admittingly. It's very difficult to see, but it filled it up with an excessive amount of grease, with no grease going in where it was supposed to. So wouldn't it be nice to know the circumstances of how that happened?
Yeah.
Was it a training issue? Was it a tooling issue? Right? It would really be nice in telling on our maintenance departments and our procedures if we could identify that. So I'm holding my breath that this investigator will go the extra little bit and look at those, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
We've talked about it on this show. And the fact is that, and I preach it every time I go out and give a speech, and we've talked about it between the three of us, that is everything that happens in the cockpit with a flight crew happens in the hangar with maintenance techs. You have fatigue, you have complacency, you have distractions, you have issues with procedures and policies, you have training issues, you have all of those things. But like you said, John, we give all the credit and we give all the blame to the guys or the gals sitting up front in the cockpit. We put the focus and the spotlight on them. But what happens above the wing can happen below the wing. And we really need to give below the wing people that attention, good, bad, or indifferent. Because one, without them, we don't go anywhere. You got a broke airplane, you're going to be sitting there. Why? Because they make it fly, not you. And so, you know, they are a critical part of this collaboration of quote crew. And so it's imperative that when, you know, you're thinking about a crew, you're thinking about not only pilots and flight attendants and that kind of thing, but you're also talking about maintenance people because they are part of the crew, even though they don't ride along on that airplane. So you bring up some good points, but when we look at this as a sequence of events, this accident didn't just happen with the lowering of the landing gear on approach going into Scottsdale. It actually happened sometime previous. And I know, Todd, that you researched there was a hard landing about a year, not even a year, prior to the accident.
That's correct. It was a hard landing, or rather a landing short of the beginning of the runway in McAllister, Oklahoma, that happened in June of last year. That did not result in an NTSB investigation, but we were able to get a photograph of that damaged landing gear. And from the looks of the photograph, which is available on the video version of this, you can see that there's damage to the landing gear tires, but not really any detail as to what else might have been going on. Now, this brings me to a picture from the current investigation, figure seven exactly. And John, you mentioned something about the grease went everywhere, but it didn't go in the hole. Well, I'm confused because I'm looking at figure seven. It shows a whole lot of grease all over the place. And I'm assuming that in a well-maintained aircraft, you're not going to see this kind of sloppiness all around. If you were to look at that picture and tell me, where should the grease have gone as opposed to where it ended up in this picture?
Well, if you look at the picture, it's all around the perimeter of the hole.
Mm-hmm.
That hole had a pin in it that came from the spar, a hardened pin, and that pin needed to be greased. So you can see it all around the perimeter, but you don't see any grease inside the hole. But if you go over to the picture to the right side, where the pin is sticking out, where it broke, that's mm-hmm. where the grease should have been.
Okay.
All right, the grease should have been all over that, what's left of that bushing and the bolt, retention bolt, but there's no grease there. So it didn't get adequate grease. However, I don't think that the grease issue is the end of the story here because of the time lapse. And I was trying to find out how many landings this airplane made, but I don't think it made enough that the grease, absence of grease, could have caused this problem.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to ask, is what did they do to that landing gear to do an inspection? And then as far as the at least reconstruction or reinstallation of that landing gear, you know, could this be a reflection on the fact that they either failed or did not properly follow procedures in the reinstallation back in June of last year, whenever this event happened? And over a period of time with gear cycles and things like that, it created an issue that, you know, was progressive and culminated in the failure on this particular day and landing.
When I look at the paper, what they said on the paperwork was that they inspected the airplane. Hard landing inspection for the airplane. That tells me they were looking at the structure of the airplane, and they had to remove the landing gear to do the inspection. So they removed the landing gear to inspect the airplane portion. They don't mention, not one word is mentioned about what inspections they had performed on the landing gear itself. And it may be that that pin that's so important in this installation was in fact had a failure in it, had a crack or something.
Did the main landing gear tires or wheels get damaged in that event?
The tires for sure, there was damage there, but the picture was too small and too dark to really tell if there was any other physical structural damage to the main landing gear.
I would hope that the NTSB will run that to ground, run all those procedures, find the person who actually touched it or multiple people that touched it to see what they did to inspect it.
So, Sherry, when I'm calling, I know that you offer a variety of different products because I have CFI insurance through you. What other insurance products do you have for individuals?
We have non-owned policies for those people that are going to flight school and they need to have supplemental coverage or the school's requiring it. In addition to that, non-owned CFI coverage where you're flying or instructing in a borrowed or rented aircraft. We also have, of course, owned aircraft policies. And in addition to you just using it for personal use, some incidental instructing as well. We would have to talk with you about the type of aircraft. We do insure some flying clubs, equity-owned flying clubs, construction policies. When you get that kit plane and you're building it in your garage, we have coverage for that as well. We also have coverage for experimental aircraft. And then finally, our policy does offer coverage in Mexico, the actual policy territory. But we also partner with another company, McAfee and Edwards, where they provide additional coverage for Mexico.
Why? Why do I need that?
Well, sometimes, depending on where you're flying into Mexico, they, for example, may want you to have a policy in Spanish.
Huh?
you have an incident in Mexico, you want to make sure that you're covered,
sure.
and that there's not going to be some kind of conflict. You know, you're in a foreign country, so it's good to do your research when you're flying down that way.
Now, I know a lot of people fly out to the Bahamas, or they may go out even to Costa Rica or mm-hmm. Panama on their airplane. Do the policies cover that, or do I need a supplemental
policy? No, it does cover the Bahamas. There are certain areas. Puerto Rico is covered. I believe Bermuda is not covered. There's certain areas that we would have to talk. Central America, Mexico is covered, but Central America would not be covered.
So the point being that if you are a client of Avemco, mm-hmm. I should pick up the phone and make sure that my airplane's right. covered if I fly to someplace right. outside the United States.
Well, and the great thing about our website also is the policy is actually printed on our website. It's 10 pages. If you go visit our website, if you're insured with us or not, you could go and see what the coverage offers. Mm. Very last page of the policy booklet is a territory map.
Oh, great.
Super easy to understand. It tells you what longitude, latitude lines, and shows actually a picture. So you could actually go there, and of course you can always call us.
You know, when we think about landing gear and landing gear issues and failures and that kind of stuff, while it's hard to really determine whether or not your landing gear is going to operate properly on a retractable landing gear airplane prior to departure, there are certain things that you'd want to look for on a pre-flight inspection that you're always preaching about, John. And a lot of those things can actually also apply to a fixed landing gear airplane, especially, you know, looking at on a low wing airplane like a Cherokee 6, where you may have, and I'm not talking about the retract Cherokee 6, but the fixed gear, where, you know, or a Cessna 172 that has a spring strut landing gear, where you're looking for certain things. You're looking for just abnormalities. A lot of the landing gears are painted and that kind of stuff. And I know that, Todd, you're currently flying. When you inspect the landing gear, what are you looking at other than to make sure that it's, one, still there, and two, that it's still attached to the airplane?
Well, I'm looking for some of the obvious things. Is the LDO strut showing too much or too little space, meaning that there's possibly something wrong with the nose landing gear especially, because I fly a 172? And looking for other obvious things like, is it flat? I had a flat tire a few months ago, didn't fly that day, but it was pretty obvious walking out of the airplane, even before I began my formal inspection, that, well, I think this airplane is broken. So again, I don't just follow the checklist. I sort of like get a mental picture of the entire airplane as I'm walking up to it. And I methodically go through and look at the landing gear as much as possible. And if there's a space in the landing gear area, either the main landing gear or wherever, where I need a little bit more light, even during daytime, I use my flashlight to make sure I see everything I need to be seeing.
And John, you and I talked offline about this, and that is, you know, when you're looking at landing gear, like we talked about, you know, a lot of the structure itself of the landing gear is painted, and a lot of times it's painted white. You know, one of the things that when I looked at 172s or 182s, whatever had a fixed gear, I was always looking for cracked paint, because that was a giveaway for me that strut had really flexed to break that paint. Now, yeah, could it be just the paint? Absolutely. But it could also be indicative that, you know, somebody dropped that airplane in from 20 feet on a training flight, spread that gear. Of course, it rebounded back. But did it create a crack? Did it set up a stress riser that could cause a failure at some other point? And when you look at low wing airplanes with its fixed gear, while it's hard unless you crawl under the airplane and with a flashlight, you really have to look for those things. But definitely on a retractable landing gear, you got to stick your head down in there just to make sure that there's nothing going on with that wheel well, that the gear, because I mean, like with my Comanche, I knew that, and I saw this during a gear swing, that the gear would never fully tuck up into the wing. And, you know, it was always hanging down just a little bit. And people said, ah, that's normal, that's normal. Well, no, it was really indicative of the landing gear transmission, the motor itself and the transmission that translates that gear up and down, was failing because it wasn't pulling it all the way up, no matter what the adjustment was. And it's those little things that are going to be the difference between, you know, flying successfully and landing with a good solid gear versus having to make an emergency landing with a gear up, or you got a gear hung up in the wheel well or whatever, because of something that was kind of obvious or could have at least been seen during a pre-flight inspection, a good pre-flight inspection.
You know, when I talk to pilots, student pilots and veteran pilots, I have to be careful because I'm looking at an airplane as a mechanic and I'm looking at it differently. I start an inspection on an airplane regardless of what I'm doing on the way out to the airplane, like Todd mentioned. On the way out, I'm looking at the airplane. I was recently going to go flying with a guy in an airplane, and it ended up the weather was too lousy to go. But as we were standing in front of the airplane, I'm looking at him, and I'm just beside his head. I'm looking at the lower rivets, and I said, there's seven smoking rivets right there, seven loose rivets. You know, have you seen that on your airplane? He had no clue.
Yeah.
He had no clue. I mean, so I have to be careful when I try to, you know, when I'm talking to people, trying to hold them to a mechanic's view of an airplane instead of a pilot's view. But some of the things that pilots can do can save their life, like loose hardware on flight controls, as we've done accidents because of that. And they don't just, they loosen over time, over weeks and months, and sometimes even longer, that we've had many, many walk-arounds, and they've never picked it up.
Yeah. And there's, here's
if
a little something
see
from
it, you should be looking at it.
And on a previous show, maybe, 60, 70 shows ago, so you fans out there probably remember me telling you the story. If it looks out of place, ask questions. One day I go to the airplane, and one wing, all the bolts that were connecting various parts of the flap were brand spanking new. And the other wing, they look normal. I'm thinking, why do I have a bunch of new attachment hardware all over this wing? I asked some questions. Turns out the aircraft had a wing strike incident, and the wing had been repaired and replaced. That's cool. I didn't know about that. I mean, I flew that day, but afterwards I thought to myself, you know, if I'd known ahead of time that this wing had been replaced, I'd ask questions like, okay, how long has it been flying since it's been replaced? What was the problem that caused it? Is there anything squirrely about it since the wing got replaced? And can I have another airplane this week?
You know, it's the little things, and we talk about it all the time, that, you know, that's what being a pilot is all about. You're not looking for obvious things. Yeah, the wings are still there, the tail is still there, and the vertical is still standing up. Okay, that's great. But we've seen in the past, and there's a number of photographs and a number of videos on YouTube with people that were pre-flighting, especially Piper or PA-28 series airplanes, where they go out as they're pre-flighting, and there's a gap between the wing root and, of course, the fuselage, and there's a rubber strip that covers it. It's a weather strip. But you got to go move the wing because, again, there's been accidents attributed to this where the wing bolts, or at least and Jason, you and me, John, have talked about these PA-28 accidents, where we've had some of the attach bolts or the attach plate itself in the spar fracture. And now you got a loose wing. And you go out there and you can move it, and you can move it an inch and a half or 2 inches. Guess what? You better not be flying that airplane. So, I mean, and any time I fly, you know, a high wing airplane, yeah, I shake the wing a little bit just to see if it's solid. But it also does another thing. If there's water that's trapped, especially in a wet wing or a bladder that has maybe a wrinkle in it, if you shake the wing a little bit, it helps migrate that fuel and the water to the drain. So again, it's those little things, because you can pre-flight, and I know people that are pre-flight and go, man, I checked that fuel, it was clean, there was no water. Next thing you know, they crap an engine because of water. And it's like, I thought you said you did that. Well, I did. Well, no, because that was trapped water in a wrinkle. And, you know, by shaking the airplane a little bit, you get it. And on a wet wing, you want to make sure that that water migrates, because like on Moonies, where, and John, you and I worked this accident where we were looking, you know, they covered up the lightning holes with, you know, sealant because they had a wing leak. They cover up the lightning holes in the ribs. And now you're trapping this water outboard of the fuel or the fuel drain. And next thing you know, as that airplane's bouncing around on taxi or in the air, next thing you know, that water is migrating. So it's the little things. And when it comes to a landing gear, whether it's fixed gear or retractable gear, you really got to look at it. If you stand back and you see one gear leg that's canted out and the other one is like this, you might have a problem. You know, yeah, it could be that the airplane is sitting cockeyed on a ramp. Okay. But you've got to check it out. You can't just write it off.
Complacency and the rush to go fly, especially fairly new pilots, they're anxious. They want to get out. They want to go fly. And they overlook some things.
I think that, you know, I'm hoping that the board will have a very good factual report when they put the final report out, since we were just talking against the prelim. But I think that hopefully they will run all of these issues to ground and really come up with some good learning lessons for us to talk about in the future. So transitioning from that, Todd.
Before we transition, we have to talk about other aspects of this. Obviously, the main landing gear was the main part, but we should talk about the post-crash situation.
I'm glad you brought that up, because you found an interesting little tidbit.
Indeed. Unfortunately, this aircraft ran into a Gulfstream that was sitting near the runway, and the pilot flying was killed. And the co-pilot was actually trapped in the wreckage for a couple hours before the rescue crews got them out. But we had two passengers in back, apparently one of whom was not belted, because they came to a sudden stop. And sometime after that, one of the passengers regained consciousness, undid her safety belt, and her first action was to struggle to get the emergency exit door out. And it was kind of challenging because the right engine was still running. This is the right emergency exit door. She got out on the wing, took her two dogs, got out on the wing, then came back and got the passenger who was not belted in and also unconscious. So it's a good thing that she was a heads up when it came to this, got everybody out of the cabin. My question is, in a situation like this, and both of you are dog owners, as I am too, what would you have done? Who
dog
would you freak
first.
Out of there?
Dog first. There's no dog first.
Especially if the other person was your spouse.
Now, I have to admit, I thought through this in my head on a commercial airliner. You know, if I had my dog with me, what would I do? I would not leave the dog behind. Yes, an earlier show, we admonished passengers for taking items out of the cabin during an emergency evacuation when the flight attendant told them not to. But I don't care what the flight attendant says. If they say, sir, leave your dog behind, I'll say, sir or ma'am, no thank you.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I know, Todd, you have a little dog like I have a little dog. I'd pull that dog out of the carrier, stick him in my shirt or my jacket and go. But that dog's my priority. Now, my wife might not like it, but that's my priority. But you bring up a very good point, and we should remind our listeners and viewers, is that in this particular instance, because you had an engine running, that engine is extremely dangerous from the standpoint that because that engine is in close proximity to the wing, and if you're coming out over an overwing exit, that's a giant vacuum cleaner out there. While you may not have a loose object like a hat or something, you get too close to it, and John and I have worked a couple of these accidents where mechanics have been sucked into those engines, and they did not fare well. And we've seen it with ramp rats or ramp people working around the aircraft, where, you know, they got too close to the inlet of an engine and got sucked into that engine. So, you know, yeah, you saved the dog, but that dog may be coming out of your arms because that engine's right there. It's a giant vacuum cleaner. You have to be cognizant. You have to have situational awareness. So before you stick your head out and step out onto that wing, listen, yeah, that engine was running. So, okay, if that's the only way out and you got to get out, then make sure you go forward and not backward because those are tail-mounted engines and things like that. It's the little things that will help preserve your survivability, if you will, when you're evacuating. John, when I did Korean Air, the sad thing with Korean Air 801 in Guam was that there were survivors. There were a couple of flight attendants that did survive. They got out of this mangled wreckage, and as they were leaving, coming down the side of the aircraft to try and get away, one of the engines, which was in a precarious position, had broken loose and literally rolled over and killed both those flight attendants. So they survived this horrendous accident only to be killed trying to save themselves. So for passengers, it is all about situational awareness. Okay, you just survived the accident. You've just gone through your checklist of, okay, I'm in one piece. I can do something to get out of this aircraft. But you don't want to become a serious injury or fatality because you got out and you either jumped out of the aircraft into a pool of fuel that now flashed over and you become a fireball, or you get too close to a running engine that did not shut down or the crew couldn't shut down, which we've seen in the past as well. So that leads us to the last word. And John, it's all yours.
Yep. And as usual, I got to do my preaching. You know, if you're going to go flying, need to plan. We've given a couple examples where pre-planning could have made a difference. And so you need to do a plan before you leave for the airport. Do it again at the airport. Make sure they agree. Take into all the different considerations, not just, you know, the generic ones that you find in some of the manuals that deal with only the aviation piece of flying. You got to deal with, like, the terrain between here and there, not just the weather between here and there. Do you want to have a little extra fuel because you're going a long way? Can you take a little extra fuel if, you know, the airplane takes the weight? If not, maybe you want to make a stop along the way. God forbid we're going to make a stop, but maybe a prudent thing would be to make a stop and going over areas where there's just no place to land. You know, find the highway, and maybe you get lucky. But, you know, make your own luck. Do pre-planning. When you get out to the airplane, take a good look at it. We talked about the Learjet. Could that have been seen before? I don't think so. All right, but there's been plenty of other examples where it could have been seen. And Greg and I talk about a number of the accidents that we've done where flight controls were disconnected. He talked about the wing that was loose because of wear in the attach points. I mean, those are all detectable on the ground. You know, I tell people all the time, touch your airplane, move your flight controls. If you got a low wing or even a high wing airplane, if you're tall enough, shake the hell out of it. See what it hear. All of a sudden you start hearing clunking, you're gonna be say, oh, what's that? You know? So there's all kinds of things that you can do to protect yourself from these admittedly rare events, but they don't happen rarely. We've seen them over and over and over again every year. You know, I haven't looked at the last couple of years, but I think we're still up around 1,000 or 1,200 general aviation accidents a year. And that's a lot of airplanes. Yeah. That's a lot of opportunity for missed opportunities for preventing them. So pay attention. Pay attention. And especially when you get in the air, there is just so damn many new pilots out there. And as new pilots, we're going to make mistakes. I made them when I started. Right? And you don't want to be part of it. And we just had that collision with two airplanes in Arizona, an uncontrolled airport. Where were their heads? You know, well, it was one airplane that had the problem because he overtook the other one, came up from the back. But where were they? What were they looking at? So just please pay attention. Right? As Greg says, it's the little things. Pay attention and please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
According to Avemco claims data, 34% of aircraft accidents happen on landing. Does this number surprise you? Avemco Insurance Company values safety and believes strongly in continuous pilot training and education to help prevent these accidents and promote safer skies for everyone. That's why they sponsor the Fast Team Wings program and the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Avemco rewards safer pilots with premium credits through their Safety Rewards program. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're one of our listeners. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety.
That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detectives. Until the next episode, fly safe.
Premium credits are subject to underwriting guidelines, including Avemco recognized training and memberships.